Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. Today we have the second and final part of a two-part presentation of the story of the mysterious murder of Harry Agee and the prosecution of his wife for the crime in 1921. Yesterday in part one, we heard the evidence and the lengths to which the prosecution went to make its case against Louise Agee and her stoicism in the face of it all. Today we'll start with the trial. Here we go. Although the trial was initially scheduled for September, it was moved back to July to reduce the amount of time the family members from Missouri would be stuck in town. By an odd coincidence, that change meant that this case would be the last major murder case tried in Oregon before an all-male jury. The 19th Amendment had passed the year before, and women were now voters. The jury system had taken an extra year to respond. Given the domestic nature of this crime, there was much speculation over whether women as jurors would be more or less sympathetic to the grim widow in court, but the question turned out to be moot. As the jurors were interviewed, the primary question the state was asking each one was whether he would be okay with sending a woman to the gallows. Anyone who said no was dismissed from consideration. The trial started on July 27th with the state presenting its evidence, and it looked pretty damning, at least at first. The physician who was called to help the dying Harry Agee testified that as far as he could tell, Louise's side of the bed had not been slept in. The pillow was still fluffy. Klecker, the music teacher, took the stand and told his Stag magazine story about Louise's unrequited passion for him. He went on to quote-unquote confess that they had been quote-unquote inappropriately intimate several times during trombone lessons. The crowd murmured disapprovingly. Louise looked through him as if he weren't there. Then it was Attorney Collier's turn for cross-examination. He immediately put Klecker on the defensive with a series of questions about the timing and relevance of the infidelity testimony, which culminated when he suddenly stooped and pulled a dark, blood-stained overcoat out of a traveling bag at his feet.
"Did you ever see that coat before?" he demanded.
It was a complete surprise to everyone in the courtroom. A dark overcoat corresponding to what Louise Agee had said the intruder wore, liberally stained in human blood with a sharp and also bloody hunting knife in one pocket and a sheet of trombone music in the other. As everyone subsequently learned, the coat had been found rolled up under a fern by J.D. Swing, Louise Agee's father. Swing said that after it became clear that the police had quit looking for further clues, having become convinced that they'd already solved the case and need not bother further with it, he'd spent most of his time in Portland hunting through the neighborhood looking for more evidence. He doesn't specifically say, but he probably had some idea of finding the murder weapon. Medical examiners had already testified that the wound in Harry Agee's throat was of an odd shape for a razor cut. It was deep in the middle and shallow at both ends, with impact damage on the lip of the cut as if the fixed hilt of a knife had struck the flesh as the blade sliced through. The wound could have been inflicted by a razor, probably, they said, but a short, very sharp knife was a more likely weapon. During Swing's search for that weapon, he had come across a tightly rolled bundle under a clump of ferns. He saw it tucked in there when he parted the ferns with his walking stick, and then, before touching it, he ran down the block and got a couple of passers-by to witness his find. They came, and as they watched, he unrolled the coat and found the knife and the music sheets in the pockets. Swing had then contacted Attorney Collier to ask him what he should do with the find, and Collier told him to hand it over to him and keep his mouth shut. Then, at the exact moment in the trial when it would have the greatest psychological impact, he produced it in court with a flourish. This is the sort of legal tactic that would never fly on Perry Mason, but apparently in 1921 the rules of discovery were different. Was it real, this coat, or was it a plant? Subsequent testing gave conflicting answers. The blood on the coat and knife was human, and there was a lot of it. It was hard to imagine how the thing could be faked up. Somebody would have had to donate several pints of blood to do so. But a late summer storm had dumped over an inch of water on Portland in the 4 weeks the coat had supposedly been rolled up under the fern. And the blood wasn't washed away, and the sheet music wasn't water damaged. Maybe that could have happened if it was rolled up very tightly? Also, the presence of the trombone music seemed suspiciously on the nose. It wasn't the kind of thing a burglar would take from the house, and if Klecker was the killer, why would he pack sheet music around in his overcoat pocket? It really only made sense as planted evidence. In any case, there was enough ambiguity that the state's case probably could have survived this blow if not for several other things that the court learned about Klecker. First, that he hadn't had a steady job for more than a few months at a time since the First World War ended. At the time of the murder, his day job was as a janitor. Teaching trombone lessons and playing in various brass bands was a side hustle for Klecker. This, of course, gave everyone the strong impression that he was very flaky, and it has to have crossed the jury's minds that no woman with two young children would be stupid enough to murder a strong, well-employed husband in an attempt to catch a man like that, no matter how attractive she found him personally. Secondly, Klecker admitted that he had told between 12 and 25 people his panting vixen story since the murder had happened. This, of course, made him look like a cheap locker room boaster. Finally, it was revealed that Klecker had, 2 weeks after the murder and while out on bail, traveled to San Diego and hastily married his sweetheart there. Had he done that on the spur of the moment, or was there some reason he wanted her to be kept from testifying against him? Spouses, of course, cannot be compelled to testify against one another. After this day of revelation, the state continued to stand by its star witness, but the smart money shifted from conviction to acquittal. The tone of the newspaper coverage shifted as well, as the papers mostly stopped calling Louise Agee the grim widow. Basically, at the conclusion of this trial, everyone was utterly baffled as to what might have happened, but it was clear that there just wasn't enough evidence for a conviction. Weird inconsistencies remained. Louise Agee's testimony that she heard her husband cry out when his windpipe was severed, witnesses testifying that she'd told them she only married Harry to please her folks, the apparently unslept-in bed, and a few other things. But by the end of the trial, most people were convinced that she had not done it. And it took the jury just half an hour of deliberation to return a not guilty verdict. Louise Agee took the good news with the same sang-froid with which she had greeted most of the rest of the events of the trial, and shortly thereafter she left with her father and in-laws on an auto tour of the Oregon coast. Later she returned to Portland and offered her services in any way she could to help the police find the real killer, but nothing seems to have come of this. Early the next year, the Oregonian reported that police were suspicious that a notorious burglar known as the 5 o'clock burglar might have been the killer. This burglar had been very active in Portland up until the time of the killing and then laid low for 8 months before starting up again. Similarities in his methods. He liked to break in the middle of the night and steal while his victim slept. He took mostly low-value items like silverware and trinkets, and this led the cops to think that it might be the same person. The theory would be something like this. The burglar gets into the house, grabs a bunch of loot, takes it outside, stashes it in the bushes by the window from which he expects to leave the house, but then when he goes back in, Harry Agee wakes up. Burglar slashes at him with the knife, cutting his throat just after he yells for help and runs for the door. Or maybe the burglar was already in the house when the Aggies came home and was trying to sneak out without being heard. In any case, that seems to have been the final word on the killer of Harry Agee. The 5 o'clock burglar was caught a couple of months later and turned out to be just an old jailbird, well known to police. As far as I've been able to learn, nobody ever figured out for sure what happened that night. Sources in this story included the archives of the Portland Morning Oregonian, Portland Journal, and Oregon Statesman. And special thanks to the Albany Regional Museum staff for the story tip via their Facebook page. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for 8 of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.